Blog Talk Radio.
Art Bell has gone to bed. Rush Limbaugh won't be awake for hours. You have arrived at the Commute Faster Energy Hour. Energy. There comes a time when all good men come to realize that that disturbing hacking cough is not caused from years of smoking because they never smoked a day in their life. No, we can thank big oil, coal, and nuclear waste for polluting the air we breathe and the water we drink. But now, bringing solutions to the monopoly-caused energy crisis. And coming to you from his remote location in exile, deep in a salt mine just outside Death Valley, kind of living out my own near-death experience, I'm your energy expert and host, Ken Rasmussen, occasionally called Late Night Leroy. Greetings, one and all. This is Late Night Leroy, Ken Rasmussen, host of the Commute Faster Energy Hour. And it's a beautiful sunny day here in California. It's February 20, 2007, Tuesday. And we're going to give it another try. Thanks, everybody, for returning. And I hope most of you have had a chance to listen to the archives of yesterday's program. We dealt with some startling free energy news topics. And I encourage anyone who has not listened to the February 19 show to go back into the Energy Hour archives and give it a listen to both segments, interviewing Kurt Anaheim from Be Free Tech as well as Sterling Allen from over at Free Energy News. So, getting back to today's show, this is an echo of our first program with James A. Roby from the Lexington, Kentucky Water Fuel Museum. I'll pronounce it right this time. And he has triggered an avalanche of replays in the archives, technical problems that we had and all. It suddenly seems to be a popular show. And I owe him an apology for all the screw-ups and blunders that we made on the first show that really inhibited the fantastic amount of information that he had to present. So we're going to give it another try today. And so, James, I want to welcome you to the show.
Thank you.
If you're there, okay.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Yeah, just give a quick synopsis of the two or three inventors that you had mentioned last time back in the 1800s. Who had actually started pulling hydrogen out of water and powering a vehicle?
Well, of course, Nicholson and Carlisle were the two British scientists who actually one was a chemist, one was a surgeon, and they were the first ones to do electrolysis in the year 1800. We didn't talk about them, but 5 years later, Isaac de Rivas, who was a Swiss inventor, he had a lifelong dream of making a self-propelled wagon, and in 1805, he succeeded in running the first internal combustion engine automobile, which was basically a wooden wagon with about a 5-foot-tall vertical piston cylinder. It had a 150-pound piston down at the bottom of it, and when you opened a valve and admitted hydrogen and oxygen into the lower part of that cylinder under the piston and lit it with a spark device that Alessandro Volta had invented, the piston was thrown upward, and because it weighed 150 pounds, when it started to travel back downward by gravity pulling it down, that's when the vehicle would move forward in lurches. And it was actually capable of going up a very steep hill, and it had a lot of torque. It didn't go very fast, and it was jerky. So they say in the history books that it was unsuccessful, but hey, he didn't have anything else to go on. I mean, the guy was inventing something that had never been done before. There were steam cars prior to that, but nothing with an internal combustion engine.
Mm-hmm.
So his technology wasn't the best. We can look at it now and laugh. But hey, the guy did something phenomenal. And one of the things he did that we haven't been able to do is to actually come out and admit that you can have a hydrogen-powered internal combustion engine that doesn't require high technology to produce. He did it using rudimentary stuff.
That is just really mind-boggling to anybody today that knows how addicted the whole planet is to putting gasoline in your car. And we just think that there's just no other choices out there, no other options, and well, we're going to have to rely on the scientists at NASA to come up and give us an answer. But shucks, you read the PR releases from NASA, and they're off chasing helium-3 on the moon or other obscure, bizarre, hyper-expensive stuff like that, and that's not going to help mankind here. So we've had hydrogen. Yeah, we've had hydrogen powering vehicles as early as the 1800s. Now, just before we move on then into the 1900s inventors, I need to interject here something I should have mentioned right at the opener. James has written an excellent compendium of hydrogen fuel historical facts in a book that I've got here in front of me now. And first observation when you first open it up is he had the aging baby boomer in mind, because I see he's used a very legible large type font on all the pages. So it's kind of a thick book, but he uses a nice legible type font with plenty of illustrations in here to cover the points and just show how these various associated technologies have been in use here for way over 100 years. So I got to recommend this book, and from the show notes, and we'll mention the website at the end, you can go to his website and order the book, and it comes with an accompanying DVD with three fascinating interviews of contemporary hydrogen inventors. So I have to give that a recommendation. So, okay, James, unless you want to add anything on the book right now, let's move on then into the next century of inventors.
Okay. Yeah, we wrapped up the 19th century rather, the 1800s, with two inventions that were later improved upon during the 20th century, and that was a carbon arc underwater, which more recently Ruggero Santilli has improved upon and calls it magna gas. That's what he calls the gas that comes out of that. And then the three guys who came up, yeah, that was, I'm sorry, that was the carbon arc. Three gentlemen did that. But then there was a guy by the name of Luther Wattles who lived in New York City, and he came up with a hydrogen production cell that also generated electricity, by the way. It was like a battery and combustible gas production cell.
So that was the first cogeneration plant then?
Well, that's very interesting. I mean, it wasn't acknowledged until a Bolivian named Francisco Pacheco was invited to the U.S. in the late 40s by the U.S. vice president, who happened to be visiting his country. And the Bolivian government was so proud of Francisco that they showcased his invention, his water fuel cell, his hydrogen-producing device. They showed him off to the vice president of the U.S., who then invited him to come to the U.S. He gave him a visa to come, and he took up residence in New Jersey. although when he got here, he was disappointed because he was told that his invention would not be appreciated by this country, that he should sit on it, that the people were comfortable with the low price of fuel at the time, and that pollution wasn't a real big concern at that time in the 40s, and so he basically was told to sit on it, which he did, until the energy crisis of 1973. And that's when he began to, which he'd already been working on it over the years. He hadn't sat idle. He had continued to work on the technology, but in the mid-70s, he went ahead and patented his invention. And he actually has two patents to his credit. One of them, the preliminary one, I'm opening my book to that. That's one thing about my book. It is in chronological order, so you can go to the section around the 1970s, and you'll see Pacheco's mention of him on page 72. And his patent, 3,648,668, March 14th, 1972, is for a gas-operated internal combustion engine. So even he goes beyond saying that I've got a cell here that produces the gas. He says, I've got an engine that runs on the gas that my cell produces. So it actually shows the accelerator pedal of a car in the drawing and how this unit is capable of entirely powering an internal combustion engine-operated automobile.
All accomplished in 1972.
Yeah, but watch this now. If you look at the references, are you looking at the patent?
I am.
Okay. You see how it says under United States Patent, Pacheco, then it says references cited?
Yes.
Now, here's the shameful thing. Look at the first reference under United States Patents.
Waddles, 1897.
Yeah, I mean, that's disgusting. Why is it that a Bolivian has to come to the U.S. in the 40s, be told to sit on his invention until the 70s when he finally goes ahead and brings it out anyway, and he cites a U.S. patent from the previous century? You know, it's really,
yeah.
It's a very sad commentary on our society.
Well, I think I can answer that with one family name. It starts with an R.
Well, and it even predates that family name that you'd like to mention. This goes back a long way. There's been, and you know, I'm not saying that I am any different from anyone else. I don't want some disruptive technology putting me out of business. I mean, I have a cleaning business. I wax floors for a living. I see the handwriting on the wall that waxing floors is a thing of the past. The new Walmarts and Krogers are now going with a concrete floor that's been polished with diamond bits. They're getting away from laying tile, and they're not going to wax their floors anymore. So I have to accept the reality of the fact that my business is basically kaput once all floors that are made of vinyl tile are out of existence. You know?
Yeah. Dealing with change is something that we ordinary human beings have to deal with on a daily basis. But if you're rich enough, you simply stomp out your competition and force them to stay in the ancient technologies, unfortunately. Yeah, and by the way, that family's name that starts with R is not Rasmussen. I'll say that up front. Continue.
Well, anyway, so going back to the early part of the 20th century, if that's where you want to go back to, there is an interesting invention from the teens, if you want to say that. This gentleman actually applied for his patent in 1916, and this is found in my book on page 44. The mention of the man, Charles Fraser. He was from Columbus, Ohio, and he received patent number 1,262,034 in 1918. And what you can see, if you look on the picture that accompanies his patent on the next page, where it says C.H. Fraser up at the top, hydrogen-oxygen generator.
So you're on page 45, was it, or?
Well, you go to the next page over, page 46.
Okay.
And
okay.
It has a picture of an internal combustion engine out of a car.
Okay.
Of course, it's an old engine from 1918.
Yeah.
You can see the engine there, and you see a little canister strapped to the side of the engine with a couple of tubes going to the intake manifold. And then you see an expanded drawing below that of his device. Well, what this device is, quite obviously, if you look at that expanded drawing down below, you can see two electrical wires connected to the bottom of his chamber and two electrodes sticking up into the water.
Well, just in figure one, you see two wires coming off it. And what does two wires mean? Two wires in the can to anybody in our field of expertise means that's an electrolysis unit.
Yeah, so people are thinking, like I called into a radio show here locally. The guy's an expert mechanic. He's a registered master mechanic. And he answers people's questions about their car, similar to the two guys from the Northeast, you know, the click and clack. Well, he's a local mechanic, but he has a great deal of knowledge about cars, and he really helps people by answering their technical questions, problems they're having. So I called him one day and asked if he'd ever heard of a hydrogen booster, which is what this invention is.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I think I heard about one, and it costs about $75,000, and it's not practical. And evidently, he hadn't really looked into it. But look at how simple this invention is. You could build one of these things. If you have some miscellaneous materials around your house, you could build one of these things for free if you're a pack rat like me. If you're not a pack rat, you may have to go out and buy a few dollars worth of materials. But you can literally build a hydrogen booster for your car for just a few dollars.
Yeah. Now that I see the cross-section there of it, this is absolutely the simplest of hydrogen boost units. And here's the patent issued in April 9, 1918.
Yeah, now my analysis of this patent, which is on the preceding pages, points out that his claims, because on each patent application you have to make claims of what your patent is capable of doing, you know.
Right.
And so on page 44 of my book I mentioned that he claims that this increases the efficiency of internal combustion engines, that it achieves the complete combustion of volatile hydrocarbons, which is what basically we're talking about when we talk about smog. We're not burning all of our fuel, and it's coming out the tailpipe in the form of smog, right?
Yeah.
Along with the nitrogen in the atmosphere that gets burned. And then he mentions that the engine itself is kept cleaner when you add this hydrogen-oxygen fuel to boost your fuel.
That's right, because you're steam cleaning the cylinders with every bang.
Yeah, and you're burning up the carbon deposits that formerly would have turned your spark plugs black and just coated your piston, the top of your piston and your head, the inside of your head with debris, right, or deposits. And then he says that as a result of using this device, you can use a lower grade of fuel with equal performance, which, you know, back in 1918, that was something. People had engines that you could run on kerosene and, you know, different grades of fuel than what we have today.
Right.
And so it was a real advantage to them at that time to have something that would allow them to use a lower grade of fuel. Well, that also means that you would get better gas mileage out of whatever fuel you did use. So two things that we need today is better fuel economy and less pollution coming out the tailpipe. And here's an invention from 90 years ago that accomplished that.
Nothing new under the sun. Well, just reapplications of a few different technologies that we knew back then and getting them brought together. Okay. Well, then, who made the next step after this one?
Well, this isn't something that I go into very deeply, but I did make mention of this on the next few pages, and that is that around this same time, between 1910 and 1920, is when there was a real uprising of claims of a chemical additive to water that would make it a combustible fuel. And, of course, there have been there's been a lot of humor associated with this kind of pill or powder or whatever that's added to a tank of water. In fact, there was a Munsters episode which had Grandpa inventing this pill, and Herman's Munstermobile was driven around on it. And it actually had more power than gasoline and so on.
There was also another Twilight Zone. It was either Twilight Zone or Outer Limits that had a program along that line. If you read the story behind the story on what was going on in the writers' minds, they touched on the concept of running a car on water, but if you look at the way that they presented these humorous scenarios, humorous, or, well, Twilight Zone was never humorous, it was always bizarre. But the way they presented the stories really implied a gasoline-type addiction to power source, thinking that, well, okay, you add this pill and it turns the water into gasoline. That was the implication there. And that's not the case. We don't need gasoline. Water itself has the fuel. It has the hydrogen that we need right in it, and we don't need to change it into gasoline. We don't need to change it into natural gas or any well, there aren't many others. The well, nuclear and whatever, that's another story. The water itself really contains all the hydrogen that we need to get the bang, the combustion on the pistons, and really get it moving. But quite correct. Television had taken a humorous punch at it, and yet I kind of saw a sinister implication in the background of each of those stories. Yeah. Any other stories there on Hollywood?
Yeah. Believe it or not, that episode that you're referring to from Twilight Zone was actually, as far as I'm aware, what you're actually referring to is a show that was similar to The Twilight Zone called One Step Beyond. And in 1960, One Step Beyond had an episode called Where Are They? And it is actually viewable on a website called liketelevision.com. In other words, they're saying their site is just like television. So it's liketelevision.com. You go to One Step Beyond, the program, and click on Where Are They? And you'll be able to watch for free this old episode, which is actually based on the story of John Andrews. Now, if you go to one of the energy websites, I think it's Rex Research, you can read quite a long story. I think George Wiseman has also included in one of his books quite a long description of John Andrews' experience in 1917.
Yeah, James, I think we had a technical glitch there. Your voice blanked out for about 5 seconds. So if you could just repeat the last two or three sentences, I'd appreciate it.
Okay, I mentioned George Wiseman. In one of his water fuel books, he makes quite a bit of commentary about this fellow John Andrews from 1917, who came up with this formula, supposedly. And that is what the One Step Beyond television program is based on, that experience.
Okay, well, that episode on Like Television, I'd like to see that again. What was the title of the episode?
It's an episode called Where Are They? And the reason why it's titled that way is because John Andrews disappeared. When he presented to the U.S. Navy this invention in 1917, he disappeared afterward and then was never heard from again. So One Step Beyond actually did a fictional reenactment of his experience in 1960.
Elaborate on his presentation to the Navy. I think I had heard I'm probably confusing him with another inventor of him, taking the military officials out in a small boat and then literally emptying the gasoline can fuel for the boat that he took them out on and proceeded to power it by water to bring it back to shore.
I think that may be the same experience, yes.
Okay. Yeah, if you know any more details on that, because, again, that's just a vague remembrance.
The fact is, we don't know how many people have come up with this kind of technology. There's a guy by the name of Guido Franch who supposedly was vindicated in a court because he was charged with fraud. But the judge, upon seeing the evidence demonstrated in the court, dropped the charges. But he did, in fact, come up with a preparation supposedly made from coal, supposedly introduced to him by a German rocket fuel expert around 1940. And so it could be that he actually did have a preparation which, when added to water, made it a combustible fuel.
Definitely possible. There are, as we'll be going into as we move ahead, there's more than one way to skin the cat to take the two atoms apart. You've got electrolysis relies on your electrical power, but then you can also pull power out of chemicals by using various types of electrolytes. And then there are reactive metals that as soon as the metal touches the water, something occurs.
Yeah, most people aren't aware of the existence of a metal by the name of cerium. I don't know if you noticed that in the opening pages of my book. But cerium is a rare metal. It's the most common of the rare metals, though. And when it's dropped in water, it produces hydrogen gas with no chemicals added, just that metal, cerium.
Now, is that an atomic element, or is that a compound, an alloy?
It is a rare element that exists on this planet that can be found, mined, and when it comes in contact with water, it causes a release of hydrogen gas.
Do you know what number that is on the atomic chart?
You know, I can't remember, but it is on there. And unfortunately, I don't have a copy of that in my book. I should have put a copy.
Yeah. On specific details like this that I know is going to fascinate both me on replay and many of our listeners, dealing with the Internet, one of the drawbacks is intelligibility, and somehow or another, bits always get dropped right at the key consonant as you're pronouncing a key person's name or whatever. Could you please spell out the name of this metal?
Yeah, cerium is spelled C-E-R-I-U-M.
Okay, C-E-R-I-U-M.
Now, it's interesting that I once saw on the Internet an article that said that Swiss postal vehicles at one time ran on the gas generated from a brick made out of cerium that was immersed in water. I suppose that when you step on the accelerator pedal, it lowers a pulley of, with a brick of this metal down in the water, and the gas bubbles out and goes in your intake. I don't know. I have not been able to find that reference again, but I saw it around the time that I was compiling my book. I did a word search on cerium, and sure enough, it came up on the screen. It wasn't on any of the energy sites. It was an older historical type reference, and I've not been able to find it again, but it would be very interesting to investigate that. Evidently, it was done only as an experimental procedure, and it probably wasn't done widely. It was maybe done on one vehicle. But the fact is that if you have a metal or an alloy that causes a copious release of hydrogen gas when it's immersed in water, you could have a very simple linkage attached to your accelerator pedal to where when you step on the pedal, that brick is immersed in water and produces gas.
This reminds me of another story I heard tied back over to all of our legendary favorites, of which who was still alive in many of our listeners' lifetime. That was Nikola Tesla. Wasn't there a story of him dipping a metal in water and running a car on water with a metallic reaction?
You know, I am not. I've never been that aware of Tesla's work until recently. I got into water fuel before I'd ever heard of Tesla, believe it or not.
Okay.
So now I've gained a great deal of respect for him and his work. I am yet to read up a great deal on him. I've been so focused on this subject that Tesla hasn't really come up much in my investigation of water as fuel.
Okay.
His coil, the Tesla coil, seems to be greatly involved in the production of the electrical impulses that cause super efficient water fuel devices to work, yes. But he himself having been involved in it, I haven't been aware of that.
Yeah, the specific, and I'm ashamed of myself, my mind's going to blank out on the friend's website I'm about to mention. I think it is, waterpoweredcar.com. It's one of the links on the right side of my energy page. Let's see. I thought it was going to be the Tesla Pierce Arrow, but I stand corrected. That was electronic.
There
was something. But there was something that Tesla did that did involve water, and I'm sorry, my mind is blanking out, and so is James today on that. So if any listeners want to email me that data, we'll pass it on the next program. Because I seem to recall it had something to do with the element boron. but exactly how it was utilized just slips my mind. So
there is some recent work being done with boron. There are some recent inventions and proposals. There are some companies that are supposedly bringing out boron type water fuel systems.
Mm-hmm. Would you want to make any further comments on that now, or should we wait until we get up to more contemporary chronology here?
Yeah, let's see. We talked about Dad Garrett last week. He was actually in the early 1930s. Well, the late 20s is when he started, mid-20s, and he got his patent in the mid-30s, 1934, in fact. So I don't know if we need to go back there. But he was quite an inventor. He was a very skilled inventor who helped the city of Dallas with several challenges that they had as they grew. For instance, he worked with the fire department throughout his life, and he helped the city of Dallas become, if not the first, one of the first cities in the world to have radio dispatch for their emergency vehicles. And because he was the first person to put a radio in a car. So it was when, I think around 1912, there were two fires that broke out at the same time on opposite ends of the city of Dallas. And the fire department went to the first call, and they had no way of knowing that there was a second call that needed their attention more urgently after they put out the first fire. And so that motivated him to come out with a radio dispatch system.
So that was the first two-way radio.
He put the first radio in a car, and that would allow an emergency vehicle to hear a call. And then the two-way communication came later. But at least initially it was just for so that a person who's on the move could get a call to go somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
In fact, in my book on page, let's see, what page would this be here? Starting on page 58 are some newspaper articles that talk about his work from the Dallas Morning News, I guess. Yeah, and on the next page it says, 1912 fires led to car radio invention, gave Dallas first municipal station in world. So there was actually a municipal radio station in Dallas that had music and other entertainment being broadcast, and it was interspersed with emergency calls, if you can believe that.
This illustrates how multiple technologies have to interface with each other for society as a whole to advance. Monumental accomplishments there. And electronics seems to be highly involved in advancing things mechanical and transportation and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. I would like to point out something about his invention which is unique and it gives us a clue as to one of the more recent rediscoveries of this technology. If you look on the second patent drawing of his electrolytic carburetor, you see how it says July 2nd, 1935, C.H. Garrett.
Yeah.
This is his son's name, Charles Garrett.
Okay, I'm looking at that now.
Number 2,006,676.
Yeah.
Electrolytic carburetor. Now look at the next page, and it's another profile of a version of this carburetor, basically the same as the other one, except you notice that it has an air tube that causes air to bubble up through the plates, those cathode and anode plates. You notice there's a tube with holes in it? It's sort of L-shaped.
And right, I see that.
It sucks air from outside air, atmospheric air from outside the carburetor, and the engine vacuum sucks that air through tiny holes from this tube, which runs underneath the plates, which are vertical. They're vertical, let's see, there's 6 plates. And the atmospheric air gets sucked up through the electrolyte and carries the hydrogen and oxygen gases into the engine with atmospheric air. And this is significant because more recent water fuel inventions have suggested that what you're actually doing is you're creating a hybrid fuel that consists of the nitrogen in the atmospheric air. You know, atmospheric air is something like 78% nitrogen and 21% oxygen. And what you're doing here is you're actually turning that atmospheric nitrogen into part of a fuel that consists of the 66% hydrogen, 33% oxygen of water, plus that 78% in nitrogen. And that is how you're able to violate the laws of physics that say that you can't get this number of BTUs or this amount of explosive power out of this amount of electrical energy.
Now, is that a piston cylinder right above the reaction chamber?
No, actually what you're seeing is an old-style carburetor. Carburetors such as we have grown up with are what are referred to as downdraft carburetors. In other words, if you stand over the carburetor and look down, you can see straight down to the intake manifold below.
Yeah.
If the butterflies are open. Well, on an updraft carburetor, this is similar to what you see on a lawnmower still. In other words, the air enters at the right there in that drawing. You'll see an opening there, and the air goes uphill to get into the intake manifold. So that's why it's referred to as an updraft.
Okay.
I actually bought a couple of updraft carburetors on eBay and had them in my museum so that people could visualize what this invention is, because we're so used to seeing the other type that we have a hard time discerning how this carburetor works.
Okay, but all right, now that I understand that, I see that it's a vacuum is placed over the surface of the reactor that has your contacts, anodes, cathodes, whatever you want to call them, that are generating the hydrogen. And he's also blending in atmosphere drawn into the bottom of the tank so that as the hydrogen-oxygen gases are sucked off the top, there's also bubbles of straight atmosphere, which, of course, is mostly nitrogen, blended in with this mix. Okay,
exactly. That's
an interesting approach. And so did the addition of the atmosphere actually help the process then?
Well, apparently so. Apparently, a relatively small electrolytic chamber, such as you see there, with those very few and small plates, was capable of powering an automobile engine that was demonstrated publicly. It was in the newspaper. No one was charging that he was a con man or a fraud. It was pretty well established that he had a vehicle running on this carburetor. And remember, a vehicle at that time had a 6-volt battery and charging system. So it was a lower voltage. And the alternator output, or the generator output at that time, was very low. Now, he says in the newspaper article that it is necessary to use a generator of double the normal capacity to operate this electrolytic carburetor. But still, the capacity of a generator at that time was only perhaps 15 or 20 amps at most. So you're not talking about very much wattage being used to run an engine. Now, you do have to keep something in mind about engines at that time, and this is something that I learned along the way. Pardon me. The early engines in the United States and around the world were quite weak and slow turning. They actually were of a different design than the engines we use now. The connecting rods were longer, and so there was a longer stroke. The engine turned slower. We have actually much faster turning engines now than our ancestors used. And so the fuel requirements of one of these earlier engines was not as great as our engines now.
Mm-hmm.
So for someone to say, well, I could take Dad Garrett's carburetor and put it on my car and it would work fine, the fact is that's not true. Dad Garrett's carburetor worked on an engine from probably the 1920s. And so we would have to beef it up a bit as far as the gas production for it to run one of our engines.
Well, if this patent was issued in 1935, cars were running on generators back then. They didn't have alternators yet, did they? I don't recall. When did alternators come along? Was that 40s or 50s?
I would think it was even more recently than that. I would think it was more like the 70s, but I'm not an expert on that, so I can't tell you.
Okay.
But I do know that the engine design changed around the the 40s or 50s. That's when what I've heard it's called the Kettering effect. Charles Kettering was an inventor and quite a genius. He invented, in fact, he's the one who first put a generator on a car in 1912 on a Cadillac, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
So he redesigned the internal combustion engine to where it was a higher compression, higher RPM machine for more acceleration. You know, people wanted speed, and of course, the early vehicles didn't have to be fast because the speed limits, you know, were so low. The roads were in poor condition, and nobody was going over 25 miles an hour at first, you know?
Yeah. Oh, looking at his design, I'd like to elaborate with a comment here. By drawing a vacuum on the top of your reactor, my generalized term here is reactor, is simply the bottle, the can, whatever that you contained all of your electrodes in, which are bubbling off the two component gases from your water, given whatever electrical current it's consuming. Nevertheless, the bubbles rise to the top. If you place a vacuum on top of that, well, this gentleman was also routing atmospheric air down at the bottom. So the vacuum is drawing off your two generated gases. It's also blending in with some atmosphere. But the simple fact that he had so many bubbles violently going through that blend then, he was also getting a fourth component here, that of water vapor.
Yeah, probably. So he was doing some water injection, whether intentionally or not, it was happening.
Yeah. That has been known for some time, jumping up to contemporary terms. I was talking to a big rig driver about it. He said that was a popular fad back in the 80s, was simply doing water vapor injection on the big rig engines.
Mm-hmm.
And when they started doing that, it was giving them amazing mileage boost, an extra 10, 20% horsepower and mileage improvement. But as they started logging up the big rig miles, and good grief, big rigs put on 100,000 miles a year or more. Some of them, I guess, can go as, 200,000 or 300,000 a year. He said once they started getting the high mileage on it, they started blowing valves, and they realized that the injection of the water into the diesel blend mix was creating a thermal problem, in that the sudden expansion of water, it moves BTUs around faster than the sudden expansion of igniting diesel fuel. So I don't know which way the therms are going, but the point is that the type of metal that was used in the valve seals and the valves was just not ready to handle the constant thermal change of cold 1 microsecond and heat the next microsecond.
Mm-hmm. The size of the water droplet that's being introduced.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that Herman Anderson, whose water car I had in my museum, something that he commented on is that some of the failure of water fuel systems, such as perhaps what you're describing, has been directly related to the size of the water particle that's being inducted into the engine. And he suggests.
Yeah. And now this is not to condemn the process. This is a surmountable obstacle. It's just a matter of using the proper metals with the proper heat treating, the proper alloys that are immune to that kind of a problem. It's just that to suddenly start doing water injection on an engine that was not designed for it is going to give you problems.
Well, you've heard of Roger Billings, I suppose?
Yes.
Roger Billings is a pretty well-known hydrogen promoter from the 70s, and he actually patented a water injection device back in, let's see when this was, I'm looking here in, I think it's in the early 70s, yeah, here it is. It's on page 81 of my book, his picture, and then the following page has his patent. Method and apparatus for hydrogen-fueled internal combustion engine. So he's recommending water injection, especially for a hydrogen internal combustion engine, because of the good effects it has on the burn of the hydrogen.
Mm-hmm. can. Yeah, good. I'm glad you've got something on him. He was actually my inspiration when I started playing around with hydrogen myself back in the early 70s.
You know something? He would be a great guest to have on your show.
If he's still around and reachable.
Evidently, he sold his company out, and whoever bought it basically shut it down. But now he's back at it again. This is what I've heard. So he would probably be an excellent one to have a discussion with on the air.
Okay. Yeah, getting a regular show going, I'm finding is 6 to 8 hours of preparation just for 1 hour show, and trying to do this as a hobby basis. Well, there just aren't enough hours in the day, I'm finding. So if I can pull off 3 shows a week, it'll be a miracle.
It's a very commendable work that you're doing. It's much needed in this world.
Well, as I mentioned in my opening monologue on the first show, I listen to a lot of talk radio, and that's really my if I have a degree in anything, I call it a degree in the School of Hard Knocks, is from listening to intelligent talk radio. And if thank God for the internet. Prior to 1995, people thought talk radio was Rush Limbaugh, Howard Stern, Art Bell. You think that's intelligent talk? I have to admit, at the time, I thought it was. And then the internet comes along, and you find that there is an abundance of PhDs in any specialty you can imagine out there with their own talk shows. And I started getting addicted to listening to very intelligent people. And once that happens in your life, you realize, what have I been doing vegetating in front of that idiot box all my life? it's just a life-changing experience to realize that some of these horrific obstacles that we as individuals face and that we as a society as a whole face, there have been answers sitting in the shadows for years that nobody knows about. Some PhD figured it out 5-10 years ago, and he hasn't been able to get a dime's worth of funding. He hasn't been able to get an open microphone in front of a radio station with any coverage to let anybody know it exists. So like I say, thank God for the internet.
Yeah, I have to agree with you on that. For instance, what I mentioned last week was that I went to the public library in search of some information on hydrogen on demand technology, and there was nothing there. I found one science book for children, probably a high school age science book, that did mention the possibility of a water-powered car, which is really quite contrary to what mainstream science teaches. But they said that with more efficient ways of breaking down water being discovered, it is likely that we will be able to have a water-powered car in the future. Well, other than that one comment, I could find nothing in the Lexington Public Library system that would teach me something about all these inventions, all these inventors, and how the water molecule can be decomposed and turned into combustible fuel. So if it wasn't for the internet, no, I wouldn't have found out about this subject either. And it was quite by accident that it came to my attention, but once it did, I wasn't willing to let go of it until I got to the bottom of it.
Yeah, and at the risk of this sounding like a mutual admiration society, James, you are to be commended for putting together this compendium of mind-boggling facts on what has already been done in this realm, and inspire any young inventors or teaching old dogs new tricks, 55 and up like me, to say, okay, let's build on this foundation that's already been done, and we've got advantages today, like we've got the internet to be able to chat with associates anywhere in the globe. I think James and I met each other through the water fuel chat board on Yahoo, and they've got members from all over the planet on that thing. So we can share information and come up with something together.
Yeah, it really is encouraging, isn't it?
Very, very much so. And we do have the other advantage of digital technology and electronics. Definitely speeds things up. so that I'm not electronically motivated myself, but talking to those who are, when you want to get something done, it used to be get out the drawing board, design an entire circuit from scratch, and if you wanted to do anything complex, I mean, it was just odious and time-consuming to do that, whereas now it's, okay, to accomplish this function, I just need this model chip for Motorola. And you call up your electronic supplier and bang, that just solved 40% of your whole process. So we've got advantages like that today in moving ahead. And speaking of technological things, I've overlooked one thing here, and I confess it's been because of my own shortcomings in learning this control panel. This is a call-in talk show. And right now, it's all I could do just to get my own microphone alive at the same time that I'm talking to my guest. But this Blog Talk Radio format does allow call-in. So if there's anybody listening live, I personally doubt that there is because the archives are showing that I have very few live listeners, but I've got an enormous number of archive listeners. But if anybody is tuned in today at 1:51 p.m. Pacific time on February 20, the call-in number is area code 646-652-2504. If you have a question you want to toss at James on water fuel history, we've got about 5 minutes left in the show that we could bring in a caller and at least get one question answered. And so I'm watching my control panel right now just to see if anybody happens to show up. No problem if we don't get a caller on this show. But the call-in number for reference for future programs is posted on the website that you found the stream at. It's posted up on the upper left-hand corner, I think it is, of call-in, and I can't even get to that page now. I've got other more important stuff on. But the phone number, I'll give it verbally once again, is area code 646-652-2504. And I do need to apologize that is a telephone. It is a charged toll call for you at this point. And once I get my website tweaked enough, there is a web-based call-in service through Gizmo that I hope to be implementing that will allow you to call in from anywhere in the world through your computer and place a little 10-minute call into the show here, but we hope to be getting that implemented here within the next few weeks. So getting back here, James, let's see, we've got about 5 minutes before the music starts playing. Let's see, what point were we at in history? We're still in the early 1900s, early to mid.
Now, there was a German hydrogen expert named Rudolf Arendt who converted over 1,000 vehicles, even a submarine, to run on hydrogen during the 1930s. I guess it was before the German government started to get pretty radicalized, and there was actually cooperation between him and some other hydrogen researchers in England and the U.S. and so on. And that all probably came to an end when the aggression began in Europe. But he was a very noteworthy hydrogen researcher, experimenter. And again, these are people adapting, you know, not coming out with some new special engine and so on. They were adapting the existing vehicles to run on hydrogen. And it seems like that kind of push didn't continue. It really should have. The handwriting was already on the wall that cities were experiencing exhaust pollution problems and whatnot.
And yeah.
Human society should have been moving toward a clean burning fuel early on. And really, people like Dad Garrett and whatnot were pointing that direction, but it just wasn't the time for it. There was too much, the influence of the greedy, and then the average person being complacent because gasoline was cheap. And so people don't do anything unless they have to,
that's the unfortunate business model used by drug pushers is offer free samples, get the addiction going, and once you know that they are thoroughly addicted, then that up goes the price. And we've sure seen that happen with oil.
Yeah. Now, fortunately, the year 2007 seems to be the year that this technology is going to become at least known. It may not be implemented this year because of the logistics of getting these devices out to the people, but there are a number of companies and individuals who are promoting fuel technologies, and they're springing up like mushrooms. I mean, just overnight, there's people saying, you know, we have a product, it works, here it is. And that happened just this past week. A company out of Massachusetts, they actually had some devices on eBay, believe it or not. And they announced they're having, not necessarily perfected, but at least getting a working model of an electrolysis unit that produces a tremendous amount of hydrogen gas, enough to run seafaring engines, so that a cross-Atlantic boat trip will require no fuel storage whatsoever. It'll remove water from the ocean, turn it into fuel, and then, of course, produce clean, actually drinkable water as, out of the tailpipe. So that was pretty exciting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, more information is forthcoming on that, but we've been in communication with one of the founders of that company, and it looks very encouraging. And Richard, I'd like to comment on this aspect of their work. Here's what this fellow told me in a telephone interview that I did with him last week. He said, we have in-house a machine shop, we have experts on internal combustion engines, and we have guys here who know electronics. He said, we have everything it takes to take a concept and bring it to fruition in-house without having to go outside this building. We can build anything having to do with a fuel system, you know, and so on. He said, so we basically looked at what had already been patented. In fact, he said they had my book on the shelf in their library. He said, we looked at what other people had done, and we came up with this system in a matter of 3 months. Now, again, I think that's a pretty sad commentary. If a small high-performance boat racing company in Massachusetts can come out with a water fuel device in 3 months, I mean, what does that say about human society in general and how we have not acted on the possibility in a timely manner?
Very well put. Well, as we hear the music start to play here, we're at the end of the show, and we have not even touched on Horvath or Pureridge or Meyer. I think those three names are an entire show on its own. So, James, I know we'll be having you back for at least another episode here.
Yeah, I'd be glad.
But if you could very quickly give out your website address.
Yeah, these are just single pages that a person can go to, and they can contact me through those pages. That's waterfuelmuseum.org, waterfuelmuseum.org, or .com.
Okay. This has been highly informative. It's such a pleasure to talk to somebody who knows the topic and can fill in, and nobody has to hear me rambling on with theories. So, James, thank you very much for your time today, and we want to look forward to a future episode. My week is booked. The rest of this week is tied up, but I'm sure we'll have you on a future episode.
I've enjoyed it.
Okay, so this has been James Ropey from the Lexington, Kentucky Water Fuel Museum, waterfuel.org. And we are going to have to be signing off here because we're coming up on being out of time. But thank you for tuning in, and stay tuned to my energy page to find out when the next program will be on. Thanks for tuning in. This is Ken Rasmussen, Late Night Leroy, signing off.